is Patricia Camilleri. Today we continue with the series The Gospels, a Commentary. I shall be reading selected Gospel passages, which will then be commented by Professor Anthony Frendo, Head of the Department of Arabic and Near Eastern Studies, and Professor Peter Vassallo, Head of the Department of English. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard, "Jesus is making and baptizing more disciples than John," although it was not Jesus himself but his disciples who baptized, he left Judea and started back to Galilee. But he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us the well and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I am he, the one who is speaking to you." Just then his disciples came. They were astonished that he was speaking with a woman, but no one said, "What do you want?" or "Why are you speaking with her?" Then the woman left her water jar and went back to the city. She said to the people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. He cannot be the Messiah, can he?" They left the city and were on their way to him.
So, Peter, we're confronted with another beautiful text this morning, the episode of Jesus and the woman of Samaria. There's much to say, both from the exegetical and literary point of view, as you well know. I just shall introduce a brief point, a couple of points. First of all, it is obvious to the reader, I think, that John is working on two levels, the physical and the spiritual level. There are many themes which are concrete and symbolic at the same time. The woman and her husband's, the place of worship, water, the Messiah, and many other themes which we'll pick up later on in the program. The first thing to say is about Sychar. Sychar is not mentioned actually in the Old Testament, but we know from historical geography that very probably it's the equivalent of a modern town, Askar, not far away from Shechem, and not far away from where people today point out Jacob's well. There is, however, in the text an allusion to Shechem in the Old Testament, which is linked with the plot of land given to Joseph. Then we've got Jacob's well. There is no such phrase as such in the Old Testament, but again there are allusions. Jacob met Rachel at the well. And the main point, obviously, is water. Now, water is often mentioned in the Old Testament as a symbol of God himself. In Jeremiah, for example, the prophet ascribes to God the words, "I am the fountain of living water." So when the Samaritan woman is asking for a drink and Jesus is leading her on to a drink beyond the physical water, he means God himself, he means himself, really. And one thing before we start our conversation is the well. The well in Judaic literature, in Judaism, had various symbolic meanings. For example, in the so-called Targumim, the Targumim are the Aramaic translations of the Hebrew Bible with commentaries. The well indicates a gift of God. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, the well is a symbol for the law. In the Jewish writer Philo of Alexandria, the well is a symbol for wisdom. So all these elements, the law, wisdom, gift, are all intertwined in John's passage. And obviously there is a crescendo of narrative here, which leads on to the confession of by the Samaritan woman that Jesus is the Messiah, the promised one. I think these themes could be all present in the text, and we could perhaps pick one or two of them if you like to.
I'd like to see it first from the point of view of a narrative which describes things as they are, without the symbolism which comes later. It is basically a commentary incorporated into the discourse of dialogue. There is a dialogue between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, and it is of interest because everything else comes out of a dialogue. Now, I having been to Israel, as we know, we went together on that memorable tour. We realized immediately, in a hot country, the importance of water. And I think the Bedouins and the people constantly on the move looking for wells, water was essential. So you have the well, which is connected with Jacob and Rachel. And it is the well is part of their community. It is the center where usually women draw water. I think the idea of drawing water was confined, the task was confined mainly to women, if I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yes. So, there are two things. There is an attractive, obviously attractive woman, a Samaritan. They are I think the fact that they did not get on well is an understatement. They disliked each other intensely.
Very much so. Very much so.
So it's an understatement, not getting on well. Of course, the Samaritans believe that you could worship, correct me if I'm wrong here, the God from the mountain or wherever you were.
From Mount Gerizim.
Mount Gerizim. Whereas the Jews believe that it was the temple in Jerusalem and that you had to have a pilgrimage once or twice or sometimes three times a year in order to purify yourself. So there's an element of purification. The well is water which sustains you. It is also a purification. Now, what intrigues me here is the tone. The woman looks a little... You can see from the dialogue, she's perplexed. here is somebody, a Jew, who wouldn't normally speak to a woman. It was bad form for a man going along to speak to a woman as she's drawing water.
Especially
from
a rabbi.
Especially a rabbi. Yeah. And even the disciples who come later are taken aback.
Yeah.
They feel that this is not on. Somehow he's
breaking the rules once again.
He's transgressed, yeah. Breaking the rules once again. And of course, the rules are being broken every time. So, and I think the tone is one of incredulity at first, with a touch of slight sarcasm. You're going to give me water and you don't even have a bucket? You know, so, obviously, Christ is already thinking in terms of the metaphor, that the water becomes a symbol of purification, the water of life which doesn't make you thirst anymore. It is, of course, the word of Christ as Messiah. And I think it emphasizes the spiritual notion of his being the Messiah. He's not a man who's coming with an army, but a man to change. No, to take over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think you correctly drew out the importance of Jesus's the narrative, as you say, which focuses on the fact that Jesus is a Jew talking to a woman. For starters, which is not on, especially since he's a rabbi, and secondly, to a Samaritan. Now, by way of background, one should say that the Samaritans were really as you say, it's an understatement to say that they did not get on well. They were really their enemies, especially by the time of Jesus Christ. And the background of the Samaritans, which will help us to understand the text perhaps a bit better, is that in 722 or 721, depending on one's chronology, B.C., so about 8 centuries before, when the Assyrians had destroyed northern Israel, you remember Byron's "The Assyrian Came Down." In that episode, unfortunately, the Assyrians were ruthless and they uprooted people, and they took, they brought people from elsewhere in the ancient Near East and settled them in Samaria, in the northern kingdom of Israel, and therefore the Jews of Judah, who were preserved from this fate at this time, looked on the northerners as no longer a pure race. In fact, most of them were foreigners. They weren't real Jews.
Yes.
Although, in fact, the religion eventually was basically still a form of Judaism, because
yeah.
they held the Pentateuch, they believed in Yahweh, and so on. So that's very important, because there is there a great divide, a great religious and semi-ethnic and religious divide. The other thing is this question of thirst. It all recalls, as you say, the geography is here very important. Water is crucial in the Middle East. And even the Psalms remind us of this. My soul thirsts for the living God. And this is what Jesus is doing. He's leading her on from physical water to spiritual water, so to say. And that's what Jeremiah had done. That's what the psalmist had done. And the other thing is that Jesus is constantly going beyond the apparent here. So we start with something physical, a well, water, Mount Gerizim, Mount Zion in Jerusalem. But he goes even beyond that. It was so crucial for the Jews to worship Yahweh in the temple in Jerusalem. And yet he says, from now on, neither on Mount Gerizim nor in Jerusalem is the essence of the whole thing, but in spirit and in truth, which in fact simply means those people who are open to the Spirit sent by Christ and to the truth which he revealed are the ones who are really the worshippers of God.
And the location is not all that important.
The location is not all that important.
But then why does he say that salvation will come from the Jews?
Yes.
If it's not important.
Exactly. Because he still is viewing, and John is actually vamping this a bit up, he still is viewing the fact that the Messiah is a Jew from Judah. So, in other words, it's as he says elsewhere in Matthew, I haven't come to belittle the law, but to fulfill it. So he's going beyond, but not erasing. It still is a fact that the chosen people up to the time of John the Baptist were the Jews. And Jesus is out of their stock, and he's saying, I am the Messiah,
yes,
you know.
He's saying it indirectly.
Indirectly. Indirectly.
Instead of saying, listen, you are talking to the Messiah.
Exactly.
He's letting her understand that she's talking to somebody who is extraordinary and who knows a lot about her life that she probably kept secret.
Exactly.
And she's stunned by this.
He's constantly leading her on.
And it's cumulative.
Exactly.
It goes on.
Till the confession of faith.
Yes. And he, also when he says, go and tell your husband. Now, it's a bit daring of a man to say, listen, go and get your husband. But, of course, what Christ is meaning, I think, is he wants to be able to tell her. He's giving himself a opening gambit to be able to tell her, I have no husband. And rightly does so say that because you're living, you have lived with five different men. So he's showing her that he knows all about her, which is disconcerting. And the woman obviously then goes down and tells...
He knows all that I have done.
Come and see, he's a prophet.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this... scholars are a bit perplexed on this theme of the five husbands because it probably is a question like the water and the well of something true and physical as a point of departure for something else. And here Saint John, well, Jesus himself and John the evangelist would come in. Now, this is not certain, but it is interesting that in the Old Testament, in the relevant chapter regarding the Assyria's planting foreigners in Samaria, which is in 2 Kings, I think, chapter 17. Anyway, the point there is that the text there says that five foreign nations have been planted in Samaria, apart from the remnant of the local ex-Jews, so to say. And each of these five had its own god. Now, two of them, however, have two gods, which makes seven, and this is the problem. But some interpreters want to say that here we have an allusion to this text, which is saying, look, Samaria is basically made out of five different ethnic groups, besides the local original Jews, and each one has its own god, and therefore here the allusion is not only to the five physical ex-husbands of the Samaritan woman, but to the fact that she is a Samaritan, and therefore there were five gods, basically, who are not on. You know, this is not on. And the sixth one is a husband, and yet not really her husband, because the allusion is to the fact that they worship Yahweh, who is the husband of Israel, but he's being worshipped in the wrong place. Now, I know this is open to criticism, because it's a bit too far-fetched, but I just mentioned it by way of a possibility.
It is, yes. Such a analysis, though very interesting, introduces an element of a kind of retrospective justification and rationalization.
By the evangelist.
I would just simply translate it as you've had five partners.
That's right.
Nowadays, you would say.
That's right.
You have lived with five different men at different times of your life. And of course, there's a gentle rebuke, but which is there for the woman to pick up and to also take stock of her own situation. She's also in need of the water which is going to give her.
And this reminds me of the last phrase when she's so enthusiastic about her encounter with the Messiah that she leaves her jar.
Yeah.
So her physical jar is now giving way to her new. You know, she came there with a jar to draw water, and at the end she has another type of water which goes beyond, and she doesn't need her old jar anymore. She forgot all about her physical thirst.
Yes. And it's interesting too, because in the passage which we haven't, well, which Patricia Cavallari didn't entirely read, it was beyond her brief, that the disciples come along.
That's right.
And they have got food, and they go and tell him, listen, you must eat now. And he says, I do not eat, I don't need this food.
My food is to do the will of my Father.
Yes, exactly.
And I think elsewhere, I don't know if it's in the same passage where he says, I have other food of which you know not. It's very explicit that he's leading them beyond. I mean, this is fantastic. This is especially, even from the literary point of view, it's a fascinating text because it manages to take something which is originally historical and it weaves it into something which is beyond.
And what I find interesting also is that usually the narrator narrates the story, but this time he allows the story to emerge from the dialogue.
Exactly.
So it is allowing the reader to make his own contribution to fill in the gaps.
Exactly.
And, of course, depending on the perceptive reader, naturally, we're talking about.
Because, in fact, it's all dialogue, as you say. Yes. Apart from the introduction, it's all dialogue.
But a dialogue which preserves both Christ's aloof character as, you know, not saying a word more, knowingly and allowing the woman to gradually realize. There's a certain slow perception. And the woman's character, who's obviously lively, and sort of saying, you know, I mean, how on earth do you want to give me water when you don't even have a bucket?
Exactly.
I mean, come on, I mean, you must be crazy, is what she's implying. But not saying.
Not saying, exactly. It's all there. Mm. And then it's interesting that at the end, when she goes to her fellow villagers, she says, come and see. Is it? Yes. The woman said to him, I know that, wait a minute. Come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. Now, this come and see is a theme which is a redactional editorial touch, I think, of St. John as he understood Jesus. Mm. Because even in the previous chapters in the Gospel of John, when the disciples encounter Jesus, come and see. And Jesus himself tells them, come and see. It's an invitation for an experience, really, basically. Yeah. So the other theme is here, which is also hidden, as you correctly implied, Peter, that to know the Messiah is only possible via an encounter which is on the level of experience, a direct encounter. It's not from hearsay.
And another thing is, yes, it's true. On the other hand, here is a stranger who's come from nowhere, who's at the well, where women usually go and a man seems to be intruding into the female sphere here. Come and see this person.
Very scandalous for his time, yes.
Before he leaves, because obviously you just have a drink and go.
Yeah.
Assuage his thirst and then leave. And in fact, later on, I think, am I right, they actually ask him to stay.
I think so,
yes. They asked him to stay. They wanted him to stay longer, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember,
they asked him to stay with them. I think
he has to
more
move
time.
On, yeah. He's got
they
to
want
on
to listen
to
now, because they too become thirsty for a different kind of...
It's contagious.
Yes, it's contagious.
Yeah. What also, by way of conclusion, in a sense, this passage of today drives home the point, which is recurrent really in the Gospels, of the way the Jewish writers, because basically obviously our evangelists are Jewish, all of them, what happens is that they succeed to intertwine in a way which we can't always understand in the West, something which is physical, historical, experiential, which something which goes beyond. And this particular dialogue of today does it in a unique way.
It's true. It exists on a realistic level.
Level.
You could feel that somebody is recording it directly.
And at the same time, it's symbolic.
It goes beyond.
It goes beyond.
Yes, that is the greatness of
this
John.
Is,
I mean,
the art of John
the,
also.
You see the naturalistic level intertwined with the symbolic.
This is it. And as I said, the well itself could mean wisdom, the law, or the gift. And that leads on to the further theme of, I give you the water, etc., etc. I think that is should be satisfying for us to get the water which will quench our thirst. Mm-hmm.
understand, or if you don't, if you believe, or if you doubt, there's a universal justice, and the eyes of truth are always watching you.